break your future today. This is part 24. We went right through the book of Joshua and then into the book of Judges. Today we'll be in Judges 17 and 18. This teaching has 5 points. We'll do 2.5 points this morning, and we'll do 2.5 points next Sunday morning, and then there's one more teaching after that. The subject is, what right does God have to tell us how he is to be worshipped? What right does God have to tell us how he is to be worshipped? Because I'm not going to take the time, I'll read sections of these chapters, but I won't read both chapters right through. Let me summarize the story for you. It's quite involved. It's kind of a Peyton Place kind of a thing that takes place in Judges 17 and 18. It deals with this man named Micah, and his mother are the two main characters. Micah's mother, you'll see this when we pick out different passages. Just kind of listen to the story. Micah's mother has been saving up silver for quite a while to make an idol to the Lord. Not to a false god, to the Lord. She kept this money in the house. Micah lived at home with mom. Saw the money and stole the silver from his mother. Heard his mother praying and his mother pronouncing curses on the thief. And so finally he confesses that he took the money. And she's just so pleased somehow with his honesty that she overlooks the fact that he's a thief. And she takes the silver when it's been recovered, and she takes a portion of it and makes this idol that the people will worship. Micah sets up one of his own sons as the priest, and the people from the area come and gather at the first church of Micah and worship God. One day a wandering Levite comes along, and Micah, being thrilled at the opportunity of having a real priest to work in his little homemade shrine, he offers him the job, offers him pay, and he assumes that now that he has a real Levite priest with his little family worship center and his idol, that God will be pleased and God will bless him because it's getting a little closer to his commands. So everything is running along fairly well, and then one day 5 spies from the tribe of Dan come wandering through. The tribe of Dan is crowded in the area they have settled and is looking for some new property so they can expand their borders and have more room for their people. They notice Micah and his shrine en route, and they're quite impressed. And then these 5 spies, they return to the tribe of Dan, and they tell the rest of the tribe that there's a city called Laish, not very well defended, and the Danites can take the city of Laish. It should be an easy target for them. And so the Danites gather together militarily. They come, they take Laish, and on the way back, they come by Micah's shrine again, having heard about it from the 5 spies. They offer the priest more money to hire him away from Micah. They steal the idol. They take it all back to Laish, the city that they captured, and they set up their own house of worship there with the newly acquired priest, the newly acquired idol from Micah. And so, this idol that Micah and his mom had made to worship the Lord in their little house is stolen by the Danites, taken to the city of Laish, and all the tribes come and worship a pagan god in pagan worship around this idol. It's a weird story. It's important to remember one other detail as you read this, that these last chapters from 17 actually through to the end of the book do not follow in exact chronological sequence the way the rest of the chapters do in the book of Judges. These events actually happen quite early in the history, even though they're at the end of the book. So in other words, what we're seeing here very shortly after the death of Joshua has to do with the spread of idolatry and how it happened, how idolatry got a foothold among the people of God. Now, look at Judges chapter 17. Let's read a few verses. Judges 17, let's just take the first six verses. There was a man in the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah, and he said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse and also spoke it in my ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." And he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, "I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. Now, therefore, I restore it to you." So when he restored the money to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave it to the silversmith, who made it into a carved image and a metal image. And it was in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod. See, he's going the whole gamut here. And household gods. And he ordained one of his sons, who became his priest. And you're reading and you're going, wait a minute, this isn't the way it's supposed to work. And then the last verse, verse 6, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Not what was wrong in his own eyes, what was right in his own eyes. They justified it. The story may end with the tribal conflicts of the Danites, but that's not where it begins. It's really a story about convenience in religion. It's really a story about making things suit our taste, our style, our preference, our schedule. It's a story about laziness in worship before it becomes a story about disobedience through idolatry. Shiloh, where they're supposed to worship, isn't that far away. It's just over the hill. But, you know, you got to get up earlier. You got to get a babysitter for the kids. Why go all the way to Shiloh? We can set it up right here. Now, that's an important point, because laziness in obedience requiring true worship is usually the way idolatry happens. Idolatry usually happens through laziness, and I'm going to explain that a little bit in just a minute. And so Micah, he sets up a shrine in his house. He and his mother have idols made. They bow down. They worship the Lord by the use of those idols right in their own house. The proper place, again, was Shiloh. It was close enough, but they didn't want to go through all that. Micah especially, and his mom, they wanted to worship God on their own terms, in their own way. I mean, why can't God be worshipped anywhere, any place, any time? Seems to me Jesus said something like that, didn't he? Didn't Jesus talk to a woman and say, "See, the time is coming, not on this place nor that place, but in spirit and in truth, people will worship the Lord"? Was Jesus right? How many say, it's a pretty safe bet, how many say Jesus was right? Well, worship in spirit and in truth is for people who have first been trained to obey God when it's inconvenient. And that's what this whole system was for, to teach that just because worship would be in spirit and in truth, we weren't to equate that with worship being on our terms. There's a world of difference between those things. They aren't the same thing. We need to think about this a little bit. What right does God have to tell us when and where to worship? Or are those just Old Testament issues that have really no bearing on the church today? I mean, isn't worship a personal thing? Isn't it between me and God? Isn't it a matter of the heart? This is a huge, relevant issue. What do we do when biblical revelation conflicts with the climate of our day? See, we're very shaped and influenced by the world in which we live. The world doesn't just influence my thinking by the movies in the theater or the violence on television. In fact, in spite of what you might hear, those aren't even the dominant ways in which the world influences my life. I'm subtly influenced by the way I can now do my banking anywhere I like with my Interact card. And I don't have to go to one branch way across town. That used to be the way everybody banked. You had your bank and you didn't go anywhere else. Or I can do it all from home. I can do it online. I don't have to leave the house. Governments will pay to look after my children while I go to work. They cater to my needs. They cater to my desires. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's a good thing. Grocery stores are open 24 hours a day. Or you can order your groceries online and they will deliver them to your house. You don't have to go out the door. See, these business people, they know our lives are full. They're hectic. We need these things. We want these conveniences. We want them at our fingertips. Now, is this good or is this bad? I mean, the whole world, I think, would agree that it's good to a point and in a certain way. But it's bad when you start to think of everything coming this way, especially in your walk with Jesus. The whole world says, Don, you're the boss. You're the customer. You're the client. We want to cater to your needs. We want to tailor things for your convenience. We want your devotion, and we will shape ourselves into whatever you like to get it. And the whole system is tailor-made to steal our hearts. We get very used to it. And then, Pastor Don, what are you getting at? Do you want to go back to 1926? Like, is that the point of this sermon? No, here's my point. All of this rolls along very nicely. And then we come to God. We bump into a creator who loves us too deeply and too genuinely to cater to our self-interest. And so God reaches out to us, but he does it in a totally different way than the rest of our society does. He doesn't take any polls. God has never taken a poll. He has never taken a survey. He is not interested in the least what the majority opinion is on any issue. And this God comes to us and he speaks and he says, I created you. I created this world. I created everything in it. I don't conform to your plans. You conform to mine. That's the way it works. I don't work around your plans. For your own good, you must renounce your agenda for mine. That's the system. Deal with it. And so you have millions of people. I would suggest to you, you have millions of Christian people who, because of their involvement in this world around them, don't know how to respond to a God who can't be had anywhere on whatever terms I like, but who reveals himself specifically in certain ways, under certain conditions, under his authority, under his lordship. And I don't know how to deal with this God. He's so different. Nothing in this world trains us to relate to a God like that. Nothing in this world gets us ready for a God like that, because everything in this world is done as much as possible on our terms to attract our devotion. And so a God like this almost seems unreal to us. Don't know how to handle him. And that's the issue I want you to see in this text. That's what this story of Micah is all about. And I have a couple points. Don't panic. The introduction is actually longer than the points. Point number one. The essence of true worship is always, first and foremost, the recognition of God's authority over our lives. People make a common mistake in worship. Maybe some people made it this morning in this room. The common mistake of our era is the equation of genuineness of worship with expression of feeling and emotion. And this text helps correct that mistake. There's no question at all about Micah's feelings of love for God. The text makes it perfectly clear that his devotion and his mother's devotion is to God. They're building this idol to keep faith in Yahweh, because they love him and they want to worship him and they want to serve him. These people did love God. That's why she decided to set this large sum of money, which would have been an enormous sacrifice for her. Verse 3, it was 1,100 pieces of silver. And his mother said, I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. Now, therefore, I restore it to you. They love God. Where they went wrong is, and it's where a lot of people go wrong, they thought loving God was enough. For all their good intentions, both Micah and his mom, they ignore the authority of God in what they do. They're passionate about him. They're attracted to him. That's why they build the shrine in the first place. There's a way in which in their own hearts they love him. They sincerely love him, but they're not obeying him. Like, does that have a contemporary ring to it? And worship first and foremost isn't about what you and I want. And worship isn't first and foremost about the way you and I feel. It's first and foremost about what God commands and what God desires. One of the most famous lines in all the Bible, you think we wouldn't have any trouble with this, because one of the most well-known lines, even people who don't know where it comes from, one of the most well-known lines in the whole Bible is, you finish it. Obedience is better than, yeah. Most people don't know the rest of it. And to hearken than the fat of rams. It's your ears I want more than I want the animals. The most important thing about me in my worship of the Lord is that I'm understanding what his will is and I'm obeying it. Remember it all your life. Worship isn't primarily about love. Not first of all. Worship isn't primarily about choruses. Not first of all. Worship is primarily about obedience. Point number two. And we're only doing 2.5 points, so we're doing okay. The essence of idolatry is the desire to have God on our own terms. Go into Judges 17 and jump down to verse 6. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now there was a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. And as he journeyed, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" He said to him, "I'm a Levite of Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to sojourn where I may find a place." And Micah said, "Stay here with me. Be to me a father and a priest, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year and a suit of clothes for your living." And the Levite went in. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. And Micah ordained the Levite. The young man became his priest, was in the house of Micah. And then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, because I have a Levite as a priest." There's three thoughts here, and we're going to do two of them. So we're going to do 2A and 2B. First, there's the issue of the source of error in worship. As you read this account, you have to begin to ask, why does this whole issue of idolatry raise its ugly head in the first place? How do these good people get so mixed up and so disobedient to the clear command of the Lord? If I said to you, "Tell me the number one sin in the Old Testament," there's lots of them, but I'm willing to bet that most of you would say idolatry. Usually it's idolatry, the sin that's dealt with. How do these people get mixed up in this? Well, and that's why I said, remember the chronology of this. This is very early after the death of Joshua. And what that means is these people aren't long out of Egypt. Not long out of Egypt at all. And Joshua warned them in words that we studied for, I think, 2 full services. Joshua told them that if they didn't labor to hold on to the commandments of the Lord, the default, if they didn't serve the Lord, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. If it doesn't seem good to you to serve the Lord," he says, "you can go back and worship the gods you had in Egypt." Now, they're not in Egypt anymore, but they aren't being careful about serving the Lord. And when you aren't careful about serving the Lord, you go back to the default of Egypt. And the way they worshipped in Egypt was with idols. Egyptian worship was idolatrous worship. I think you can see the obvious point. If you don't work long and hard, the reason I put those books, listed these books in Seed of Your Life for the summertime when you've got some free time. If you don't work long and hard to fill your mind with the truth of God, your mind doesn't stay empty. Your mind defaults to being filled with error. It is automatic. It's automatic. You don't have to learn wrong thinking. Wrong thinking just happens to everybody. It's truth that takes effort, not error. Error takes no effort whatsoever. Error will fill up any mind that is undisciplined in the pursuit of spiritual truth. I just, not that long ago, I've shared a bit of this story. I had a bunch of topsoil and recovered my front yard, which had no grass from last year. My neighbors will vouch. They've seen me out there working. I'm not making this up. Just in case you didn't believe that I was capable of that kind of... 46, count them, 46 wheelbarrows of topsoil that I took off my driveway, spread out over my front yard. And then the grass seed. And then you smooth it out, rake it just gently. And then you water it. And the grass is coming. I don't remember planting any weeds. And I go out there and I look around and I wonder, Who plants these things? I think that parable of Jesus, while I was sleeping, some enemy went out in my front yard. It's the grass that you have to plant and work to make grow. The weeds do just fine. To grow weeds, what do you have to do? Nothing. That's the way it is with right thinking about God and wrong thinking about God. To develop wrong thinking about God, you don't have to do a thing. To develop right thinking about God, you have to work at it 24/7, day in, day out. It's called the fall. And it's the way that we're all affected. Weeds. You know how it is with weeds. You walk down the sidewalk, it's concrete. Just pieces of concrete, and I understand underneath it there's all sorts of gravel and screening and all sorts of stuff, and yet you walk out there, and but there's a crack in the sidewalk. And you know what grows there? Dandelions grow there. You get topsoil, triple mix, weed and feed, water, and if you're lucky, you can get a little bit of grass to grow. Weeds will come up through the concrete. They're just persistent little creatures. And that is exactly the same thing with the way it works in our minds. Error will fill up any mind undisciplined in the pursuit of spiritual truth. And all of that is relevant to the church, but hard to talk about. It's hard to talk about because that whole issue that I was just talking about, how you diligently have to pursue spiritual truth or the mind just naturally fills up with error. It doesn't stay empty. It's not that you're neutral. It's error. You come to believe wrong things. So this is what makes the little habits of holiness and devotion so important. But the problem is, you sound legalistic when you talk about little habits of holiness. And there are whole sections of the church who just kind of write you off as being a bit prudish and a bit outdated, or somehow not understanding your freedom in Christ. It's hogwash. But it's so convincing when it's said. Your daily devotions, Christian education, Sunday church services. How much do we need? Well, as frequently as you can take them in. What kind of a lawn do you want? These things aren't legalistic ways of earning your way to heaven. They're gracious means of keeping the ways of God from being displaced, shoved out by the relentless encroachment of spiritual error and wrong thinking. You'll worship God properly or you'll go back to the ways of Egypt. There's nothing in between those two positions. Can I say something personal or do you want me not to? Let me tell you what's right around the corner. I believe it with all my heart. What is right around the corner for the church? The question people used to ask, and they used to say things like, why would I have to go to church twice on Sunday? And of course the answer is you don't. And it's not even an issue anymore. It's virtually gone. It's not gone here, but in 99% of our churches, in our fellowship, it's over. But there's a reason for that. People have found that it's just really nice having more time for family and good things. It's convenient. But the issue that's right around the corner is a totally different one. I guarantee you this is coming. The issue will be, well, who says we have to go like every Sunday? I mean, all the Bible really talks about is not forsaking it. But I can go regularly every other week. I can go to church 1 week and then I could just read my Bible at home on alternate Sundays. This is coming. This is coming. And it relates to the next point. Relates to the next point in this message. This is 2B. There's the appeal of idolatry that we see here. There's a tremendous appeal in the idea that we are masters of our worship. I mean, Micah and his mom, they want to set it up right there in the house. Micah gets to worship in his own way. And by the way, he's not the last one to like the idea of not having to go somewhere else to worship. Micah sets the terms of his worship. He gets to fashion his worship in any way he likes. There's something necessary to include in worship that is almost always left out of the discussion. And this is how we'll wrap up this morning. We know some of the things necessary for genuine worship to take place. If I asked you the ingredients, you'd probably say some of the same things. God's word, prayer, fellowship, devotion, songs of praise, Lord's Supper, maybe some form of liturgy. Anything else? Is there anything else that's absolutely essential to worship that if you take it out, you've disemboweled the whole thing and it's not real anymore? And I'd say there is. There's one more thing. There's one more thing. There's one element that is absolutely essential to the genuine worship of our God, given the way He is, that almost never gets put on the list. And yet, genuine worship is absolutely impossible without it. Here's the last ingredient to true worship. One word. Inconvenience. There must be inconvenience if worship is to be genuine. Genuine worship must always have an element of the inconvenient to it. Well, why, Pastor Don? Why is that necessary? Why is inconvenience necessary to worship? And I'd say, well, think about it. Because without a strong measure of inconvenience, I can never truly demonstrate love for God. You can't demonstrate love for God by singing praise choruses. I'm not saying we don't love God when we sing our praise choruses. I'm saying if the person beside you is thinking about his round of golf while he's singing the praise choruses, you won't know it. You can sing praise choruses without loving God. You can lift your hands without loving God. Why do you say that worship requires inconvenience if it's going to be a demonstration of love for God? And here's why. Love for God is only measurable by its capacity to displace something else. Or to put it another way, love for God is only measurable by its supremacy over my love for anything else. Jesus says, no man can serve two masters. He could have said three, he could have said four, he could have said six. The point being, you have to talk about at least two competing desires if you're going to talk about being devoted to God. There has to be something that my love for God bumps. If my love for God never forces me to choose between Him and something else, then I don't love Him. Seek my kingdom first. And the only way you can seek His kingdom first is if you take other things that were first and you deliberately put them second, third, fourth, fifth. But until there's something that competes with my professed love for God, something where my love for God wins, then you'll never know whether I love Jesus or not. And in fact, nor will I know if I love Jesus or not. And so God sets it up through commandment in such a way that worship always has an element of inconvenience to it. No, Micah, you got to go to Shiloh. Now, we know something. Is God more present at Shiloh than at Micah's house? Is he? No. No. What's the Shiloh thing all about? That's for Micah. He needs a chance to prove his devotion to God over his own plans and his own agenda. It's for Micah. This is always the essence and the appeal of false worship. You don't have to build an idol. This is where an idolatrous heart flourishes. You probably don't bow down before a statue or burn incense, but all false worship has its roots in the same soil. We have the element of control. And we live in a world that measures our success in life by our capacity to control the terms on which we live. We almost always are encouraged to put self first in this respect. The appeal to personal convenience is the first manifestation of it. Now, here again, this world just, it can't get us ready for meeting God. Because when we come to God, whenever we come to God, we come to a God who insists, I'm sorry, he insists on interfering with us. The nerve. God insists on interfering with us. No, Don, not your terms. My terms. No, Don, it's not your schedule that's important. It's mine. Because all your time is mine. I talked to a pastor, you don't know him, but not all that far from here, just recently. Pastors get together and they talk about coping with summer. See, everybody else gets together and talks about what they're doing in summer. Pastors go into deep depression. What we're going to do about summer. And here was, this is a pretty big church, pretty thriving, happening place. And the plan was, we're going to get together on Wednesdays instead of Sundays because I find my people like to get away on the weekends. And words flashed through my mind that the most spiritual thing I did that day was I didn't speak them. Is it the case that God would bless the people more on Sunday than on Wednesday? I don't think so. Could God be just as present in that building on Wednesday as on Sunday? So no problem, right? No, there's a huge problem. There's a huge problem. Because what's happening is, here's a person who I think is sincere. What he's doing is he's saying, it's a very painful thing having to choose between worshiping God and I'm not talking now about holidays. Everybody needs holidays. I'll get my holidays. I'm talking about the regular pattern between choosing God and being able to just go away and do your own thing. And so here's a pastor who says, I will spare my people making that decision. And you know what? His people will love him because his people will think he's doing them a favor. Only he's not doing them a favor. He's destroying them. Because what all those people need, more than they know it, they need to come to terms and say, this would be lovely. But God, you mean more to me. And in making that decision, growth happens. Growth happens. Do you get what I'm saying? In sparing them that decision, he's weakening the fabric of their love for Jesus. Not that Jesus can't meet with them on Wednesday. Not that Jesus can't bless them on Wednesday. That's not the point. The point is, they no longer have to choose. Is it going to be Micah's house or Shiloh? He spared them the one thing that all worship needs to be truly meaningful. He spared them inconvenience. You don't have to build any images. You simply pick and choose your habits, the times, the attributes of the God you want to emphasize. You can emphasize his love or his grace or his kindness, whatever you like. But you form a God of easy tolerance. Without anyone else knowing it, that's the God. In a place like this, that's the God you lift your hands to and worship. You form a God. This is idolatry. There's no carved image. There's no statue. No one else sees it. You form a God who will let you date a married woman. So here's a guy who's in the place and he worships and you lift the hand. And you praise. And you worship. But the God, this is idolatry. The God is a God you've created who will, I said, who will let you date a married woman. The God who says, you can kind of slog around to church whenever you feel like it. Because after all, I'm everywhere. I'm omnipresent. You can worship me as much at the golf course or the cottage as much as you can in church. The God who says you don't have to tithe. And so you get this mold. You get this image. And that's the God after a while. Praise, worship, love. Only it's just one you've made up. It's a fictitious God. And the reason he was created is because it was convenient. And that's what I wanted you to see this morning. The link between the pursuit of convenience and the construction of an idol. Does everybody get that point? Somewhere along the way. It's not up for me to make all the rules. But somewhere along the way, you sort it out. God interferes, or it's not the God of the Bible. He doesn't cater. We serve him. And then once in a while you'll meet somebody like that who really understands it. And right in a life where you thought all these disciplines and all this work and all this effort that Pastor Don is talking about, and you see somebody who does it, and right in a life where you thought there'd be nothing but a legalistic dead religion, you find somebody whose just heart is flooded with the joy of the Lord because they've come to know God on his terms, the real God, not an idol they've made up in the back of their minds. Let's pray.